Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, May 3rd. You know, if all went according to plan, about 10 minutes ago, Vice President Kamala Harris swore in former Senator Bill Nelson as the administrator of NASA. Now, considering what's happening in this country and around the world with COVID, with racial injustice, with the climate, and a whole bunch of other things, this might not seem like the biggest story for a Monday morning, right? But consider this. It was just on Saturday that Vice President Harris herself was officially named to chair the National Space Council, an agency that most presidents over the last 30 years essentially disbanded, but that Biden says he will use. It's another groundbreaking, or maybe we should say atmosphere-breaking, leadership role for Harris as a Black and South Asian woman in a role only associated in the past with white men. And it's not just about the fun stuff like Biden's goal of sending humans back to the moon, but also national security, economic development, and they might even have to create a sanitation department for space one of these days with all the floating debris that human beings are leaving up there that's becoming a real problem. And consider this. Chair of the National Space Council is just the latest job to land on the vice president's crowded plate, which include, as listed by Politico, her leading roles in dealing with the situation at the border, plus diplomacy with Mexico and Central America with respect to that. Also leading the anti-COVID vaccine hesitancy efforts, the impact of the recession on women and on Black-owned businesses, a pro-union task force that she'll be heading up, and a push to increase broadband internet access across the country. And yet, as everyone took note of President Biden hitting his 100th day in office last week, not much has been written about the vice president's first 100 days. But one big exception to that, an article on Politico called The Misunderstood First 100 Days of Kamala Harris. So with us now, the co-author of that article, Politico White House correspondent and Playbook newsletter author Eugene Daniels, and also joining us, Fordham University political science professor Christina Greer, co-host of the FAQ NYC and What's For Us Pod podcasts, and author of the book, Black Ethnics. Christina, welcome back, and Eugene, welcome to WNYC.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Eugene, that was your story in Politico about the vice president's misunderstood first 100 days. Who did you interview, and what central question were you trying to answer?
Yeah, we interviewed more than a dozen current and former aides, people that are close to her and in her orbit who know her. And despite the fact that she hasn't been on the national scene for a long time, she's been moving and shaking in politics for a while. So there's a lot of people that you can call and try to get at. And the thing that we wanted to understand was there is this in the media, there is an idea that Kamala Harris is someone who is very cautious. And there is another one that is typically from people who don't like her, who think she's overly ambitious, right? This overly ambitious politician that is rife with its own sexism and racism for people who typically see her as too ambitious.
And boy, if you're being tagged as both too cautious and too ambitious, there's a lot of perception on the part of other people going on there.
There's a lot happening there, right? And I think that was one of the things we wanted to get at is who is she and what does she do? And I think, you know, and how does she operate? And I think what we really found was that her focus on the first 100 days, and I think for her vice presidency, is to just focus on doing the job. And it sounds like a duh. But at the same time, when you are someone who clearly she does have ambitions, right? Like she clearly wants to, she'll probably run for president again. Mm-hmm. But her focus is to just do the job. She wants to continue to gain the trust of Joe Biden. And also, she is not focused on politics. Her staff, I talked to a bunch of them trying to get them to, you know, talk about, oh, do you guys talk about how this would affect 2024, 2028? And it just doesn't. And I think that is kind of the sense that we got leaving out of it.
Well, before we bring in Christina, one angle in your piece that was very interesting to me was about Harris being intensely focused as part of doing her job on winning the trust of President Biden. Doing that in what ways? And is that unusual for a vice president in their first 100 days?
No, I don't think it's unusual at all. I think that every vice presidency starts like that, right? Because especially if you look at Obama and Biden, you know, and her in Biden, they start off from, you know, sniping at each other on a debate stage, right? One of her biggest debate moments was talking about bus segregation with Joe Biden. And so that part of it is... all of that is all in their relationship. So what she wanted to do, and something someone told us, is that she basically, the ethos is make sure everyone in the White House complex knows I have only one priority, and that is covering Joe Biden's back. And so that is how she thinks of it. And it, while it's not abnormal to try to work on gaining that trust, it does have its own issues because people think she's going to run, especially because of his age, right? They think that she's going to be in 2024, that's going to happen. You have the right wing who's been attacking her even before she took office, saying she's going to be the real shadow president. And so they have to be even more cautious, I think, than another vice president would.
Yeah, and certainly being political rivals. And then winding up as president and vice president, not uncommon. I'm thinking of George H.W. Bush, who ran against Ronald Reagan in primaries way back in 1980, called Reaganomics voodoo economics. Pretty hard stuff against Reagan, who wanted to be economically transformative. And then, of course, George H.W. Bush got tapped to be his vice president. So it happens in both parties. It happens over time. Now, Christina Greer, Biden's first 100 days got reviewed largely as, wow, look how bold he's being. He's FDR. He's LBJ. Do you see Vice President Harris as also benefiting from the glow of media-bestowed boldness? Or is it different in her case to the extent anyone's commenting or writing about that at all?
Yeah, I mean, well, first things first, Kamala Harris is in the shadow of Joe Biden, as most vice presidents are, but I think she might have a bit of a Hillary Clinton problem in the sense that if she decides to run in 2024, she will try and, you know, all of the accomplishments of Joe Biden, she will say we, and all the issues and policy points that people aren't happy with or feel like they either went too far or not far enough, she'll say, well, I was the vice president. I was supporting Joe Biden as president. That wasn't me. And so it's, you know, when we saw Hillary Clinton sort of defending her position as first lady, even defending her position as secretary of state. So that'll be an interesting, complex needle that Kamala Harris has to thread, because she will either have to take all of the accomplishments and failings of the Biden administration, or she will try and run as her own person, but that's going to be very difficult to do. And just as a side note, don't forget, you know, Joe Biden and Barack Obama had their own little toe-to-toe on the debate stage, and Joe Biden famously called Barack Obama clean, shiny, and articulate, and they were able to move past that, and Joe Biden was a very dedicated vice president for 8 full years.
Eugene, you quoted one Harris confidant saying she wants Biden's trust so that she gets a lot of authority to be actively engaged in the government. Is the list of her responsibilities that I cited from your article, the situation at the border, vaccine hesitancy, the impact of the recession on women and on black-owned businesses, a pro-union task force, a push to increase the broadband access, and now chairing the National Space Council? Wait, isn't that every job under the sun? So are these already signs of that trust, or could a lot of them wind up being sort of figurehead titles?
I texted one of her senior aides this weekend after they announced the National Space Council. And I said, you guys are really keeping her busy, huh? Because they are. And you listed off all those things. And some of them are more politically fraught, right? The number one that's most politically fraught is her role leading diplomatic efforts with Northern Triangle countries and Mexico to get at the root causes of migration, right? That one we've already seen Republicans try to paint her as the person who's handling the border crisis, and that's not the case, right? So there's already those kinds of things. I think that you're right, that trust has already been building. And because she has been focused on the governing aspect of it, not thinking so much about how this is going to impact her, how this is going to impact her future, and just concentrate on being, as it was put to me, Joe Biden's Joe Biden, that is easy to trust. And I talked to some vice presidential historians about this, and they say that is kind of what vice presidents have to do. They have to convince, you know, so far, the guy in charge that, hey, I'll do whatever you say. I'll do a good job. And I'm not here for myself. And I think that is something that she, one of the very few things she has in common with, you know, all the other white men that she has, that mm-hmm. that have shared her role before her. As far as like the figurehead role, I think it's hard to see her ever do something that's figureheady because that's just not how she operates. There's this They did a CNN documentary of her, and it was an hour long. And one of the things that I took away with this, she had just been sworn in one of her positions. She walks into her office, and there's no desk, and there's no computers. But she, like, sits down with, I think, a legal, you know, big yellow legal pad and starts to work just in the chair. You know what I mean? And so, like, that is the way that people talk about her, as someone who is just ready to work. And I think part of that is, you know, that's who she is. She's a lawyer by nature. She was a lawyer for most of her life. And just focusing on that aspect of things is how she's gotten to where she is. And I think how her vice presidency is going to be looked at as someone who really did just focus on it and had his back.
Christina, some people have said that Biden saddled her with the border job, like no political benefits could come from heading that up, only headaches. And here's a clip of the vice president on the CBS Morning Show last week after being asked by Gayle King about the extent of the problem on Biden and Harris's watch and how quickly they can fix it.
Okay, look, it's a huge problem. Yeah. I'm not going to pretend it's not. It's a huge problem. And are there, are we looking at overcrowding at the border, in particular of these kids? Yes. Yes. Should these kids be in the custody of HHS, the Health and Human Services, instead of the Border Patrol? Yes. Should we be processing these cases faster? Yes. This is, however, not going to be solved overnight.
So she's the one out there having to say that more prominently than Biden himself. Christina, how's the vice president doing on that, as far as you could tell? And how do you see the challenge, both the humanitarian and policy challenges, and also politically for the vice president?
Yeah, I think it's a massive challenge, largely because this is something that George W. Bush and Barack Obama could not figure out. You know, we know Donald Trump was wholly disinterested in figuring out. And so we know that we still have the numbers, we still have children involved. And as Eugene's great piece sort of points out, and implicitly and explicitly states, there's some gender and racial dynamics by having someone like Kamala Harris be the heavy for the hard decisions that will be made, especially when it comes to families and children. So, you know, no, I'm not the vice president, have no desire to be the vice president, because this policy position, I think, is a thankless one, because no matter what happens, even if Kamala Harris is able to solve a significant portion of what's going on at the border, there will still be thousands, if not millions, of Americans who feel as though the Democratic Party did not do enough quickly. And so if she does decide to run in 2024, we know that her opponents, very ambitious men from all across the country, will be running, and some women as well. But we know that there will men will not let Kamala Harris roll into the White House in 2024 at all. We know that this will be a cornerstone of their critique of her and her time in the administration.
Christina, another position Harris finds herself in is in being a Black and South Asian woman vice president at a time of racial issues being very explicitly on the table. And so last week, after the Senate's only Black Republican, Tim Scott, gave the nationally televised response to Biden's nationally televised speech, and Scott stated the U.S. is not a racist country, Harris was made to respond to that Thursday morning on ABC's Good Morning America. Here's how she handled it.
First of all, no, I don't think America is a racist country, but we also do have to speak truth about the history of racism in our country and its existence today. And I applaud the president for always having the ability and the courage, frankly, to speak the truth about it. He spoke what we know from the intelligence community. One of the greatest threats to our national security is domestic terrorism manifested by white supremacists. And so these are issues that we must confront. And it does not help to heal our country, to unify us as a people, to ignore the realities of that. And I think the president has been outstanding and a real national leader. On the issue of saying, let's confront the realities and let's deal with it, knowing we all have so much more in common than what separates us. And the idea is that we want to unify the country, but not without speaking truth and requiring accountability as appropriate.
So, Christina, how much of a burden and how much of an opportunity to work for progress do you see it as for Harris to be asked about race in contexts like that?
Oh, I mean, she will continuously be asked about race. I mean, that's what's sort of frustrating and exhausting about the framing of the conversation. It's like, listen, you know, Brian, we've talked about this for years. We are in a nation that is predicated on white supremacy, anti-black racism, patriarchy, and racialized capitalism. These are facts. They are not my opinions. So the question of, is America racist? It's like, we have two eyes and two ears. Like, we can see it. Tim Scott laid out all the ways that the country was racist and then said it wasn't racist. So the fact that Kamala Harris has to carry the water in this conversation is exhausting when we should be talking about how do we move beyond Derek Chauvin's trial and all the other trials that should have happened of all the black Americans who have been killed at the hands of police or vigilantes or Asian American violence that we're seeing today, or still processing January 6th. So like the framing of it to me is ridiculous because we see this in our workplaces all the time. Let's ask the people of color, let's ask the black people, like, is this environment, you know, not equitable? No, it's not. Like, that's what we've been screaming from the rooftops. So, I mean, obviously her response was, you know, measured. And because if she had said anything else, you know, Fox News and the like would have taken that for the next 4 years and played it on loop. But I mean, I think the question is actually ridiculous because we have all of the evidence. We've got 400 years of it to say that, yes, Tim Scott spoke incorrectly. He basically lied and he laid out his own argument for himself and then said the opposite.
You want to weigh in on this too, Eugene?
I think that's key. And also what's key is that what Republicans are doing and have been doing for this last 100 days and really for years, but really if we're talking about this, you know, this presidency and vice presidency, is trying to fight these, they call them the culture wars, right? These kind of things, these things about race, things about, you know, these people are going to take this from you. And that has been happening for some time. And so you have Tim Scott. One, I think the thing that was really interesting about Tim Scott's speech that on the focus on race, it was a speech that was, because that the thing that he's supposed to do is rebut what the president just did. And mm-hmm. President Biden did not give this 80-minute speech on race, right? What the things that he was kind of hitting Biden on weren't in that speech. And so what that tells you is that they want, Republicans want Democrats to have to explain their issues with racism in this country. They want them to continue to have to explain it because to them, Republican voters and maybe some independents, maybe even some moderate Democrats don't want to face some of these hard truths, right? They don't want to face some of the hard truths about white supremacy being, according to Intel, you know, the Intel agencies, not me, you know, not anyone else, but according to them, that white supremacy is a danger to this country and it's terrorism, right? And it's domestic terrorism. And that, you know, all, you know, rising tides does not lift all boats, something that we know from history. And so that is what Democrats are working to convince people of in this country, and Republicans are not. And I think that is what you're seeing here play out is not just that, like was just pointed out that Tim Scott talked about how racist things happened to him and then said this country wasn't racist. Because what they're trying to differentiate is you are not racist. They're calling you the human racist. And I think that is what Democrats aren't really doing, right? They're not saying this person is racist. This, you know, this human is racist. They are talking about the system. And I think that's a little bit more difficult to convince people of than of calling a person racist.
We're almost out of time. Eugene, I see that your White House correspondent beat includes the vice president, but also the second gentleman, as I think the vice president's husband's title officially is. How were his first 100 days?
His first 100 days were under the radar a little bit. I'm working on a story right now about them. But he's been very busy. You know, Doug Emhoff is a former entertainment lawyer out of California, very successful. And so what he's done now is something that I think, you know, I've talked to quite a few people about it. And they say, you know, it is a good example to see, you know, a high-powered man just support his wife. You know, something, and unfortunately, in 2021, we don't see enough examples of. And so what he's been doing is supporting the, you know, the administration in every way he can. There was almost, there were all hands on deck for the during COVID relief, so you didn't hear a lot from him. But then he started hitting the road selling that COVID relief plan. And he's still been on the road. I think he did like 10 trips or something. Him and the First Lady, Dr. Joe Biden, have traveled the most out of the top four because they want to make it very clear that the president and vice president are working. And so the First Lady and the Second Gentleman have taken on quite a bit of the travel selling things, but also, you know, trying to figure out that role for himself. He's the first man to be a spouse of the president or vice president, of a vice president or president. And I think they are still working to figure out what does that look like and what does he want to tackle. But right now, I think their only focus is to do whatever the administration wants them to do as they kind of struggle with all these crises that we have at the same time.
And Christina, before you go, let me raise a whole other topic just for one question for now. And I don't know if you're on the details of this yet, but it's certainly on a topic that we've talked about a lot, which is the push to restrict voting rights in state after the 2020 election. The headline in the New York Times was, "With Florida bill, Republicans continue unrelenting push to restrict voting." And to my eye, just reading this list of bullet points, but I don't really know, so you tell me, this looks worse than the Georgia law. Just reading from this Times article, the restrictions include limiting voting by mail, curtailing the use of drop boxes, and prohibiting actions to help people waiting in line to vote, while imposing penalties on those who do not follow the rules. With the limiting voting by mail, which I don't think was so much in the Georgia bill, but you tell me, is Florida's even worse? Do you have an opinion yet?
No, I'm not surprised at all, Brian, because if we look at the Florida gubernatorial races, the past few cycles, Democrats and Republicans have been separated by basically one percentage point, if we remember Andrew Gillum and Ron DeSantis. We also know that Ron DeSantis has been a very loyal supporter of Donald Trump and all of his theories about election fraud and why we need to restrict voting for all Americans, specifically people of color, specifically Democrats. So this bill is not surprising. It's not surprising since we know Ron DeSantis has future ambitions. We have two Republican senators that are on board and have been, you know, supporting the baseless theories of the former president. And sadly, Brian, I think if we compare Georgia and Florida and all the other bills that are coming up in states across the country, I think they're going to only get more aggressive as we look forward to 2024.
And that, unfortunately, is where we leave it for today with Christina Greer, political science professor at Fordham University, co-host of the podcasts FAQ NYC and What's for Us Pod, and author of the book Black Ethnics, and Eugene Daniels, who is really busy. I don't know how you're prolific as you are, writing the well-read newsletter every day, being on that team, the political playbook, and putting out as much content as you are as political White House correspondent. So thank you both so much for coming on today.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at wnyc.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.